Mark is going to discuss a little bit about lattice theory. Somebody was asking about dark matter experiments and what are the sources of data we have about dark matter. And somebody asked about spherons, what are they? And I also heard that you had problems with homework number one. So we can discuss your problems too. Should we do that? So, about the estimates, well, I'm going to do just one example of how you estimate things. Well, you probably know this in some context. And let's say you want to estimate what is the lifetime of the muon. Right. So the diagram you have to write down is this one with a Davios change. And then you say, okay, so the width of this of the muon is going to be related to the matrix elements square and some phase space. What you have to do is compute the matrix elements and integrate over phase space. And you've probably done this many times. So you can spend some hours trying to do that, or you can just do a back on the envelope computation by saying, okay, gamma, because this matrix elements is related to the exchange of this W. If I'm looking at very low energies, then I really don't care about the dynamics of the W. So I can integrate out the W. And then the matrix element is going to be 1 over mass of the W square, the propagator square. You have the coupling twice, so it's G square, and that's it. The only thing I had to do is to match the dimensions. Where are the dimensions of the width of a particle? The same as the mass of the particle, right? It's dimensions of mass. So we have four mass dimensions here. We need five on top. That's it. So you plug those numbers, you get lifetime of order 10 to the minus 6 seconds, which is the lifetime of the muon. So in the homework number 2, you have to do something similar. Instead of this, you have to integrate out a quark. So you have your gluino. And your gluino is very light as compared to the quarks. So the gluino can only decay on physical states or on shell states that are below, that have masses below the gluino mass. So the mass of the gluino is order 100 GeVs. Whereas the mass of the quark is much, much bigger than the mass of the gluino. So the only way the gluino can decay is through an off-shell quark. To what? To the lightest, for example, the lightest neutralino, to the LSP of supersymmetry. Okay, is everybody happy with this? Because the gluino is very heavy, but the gluino is a supersymmetric particle, the only way it can decay is to other supersymmetric particles. And it doesn't couple directly to the LSP, so the only way it can decay to the LSP is through exchanging a quark. But because the quark is very heavy, this quark is not going to be produced on shell, on the mass shell, but off shell. So this guy is off shell. So when you have these kind of things, the first thing to think about is this guy is going to be long-lived. Why? Because it takes a lot of time to produce an off-shell particle in an efficient way. So let's do that. Let's estimate what is the width of the gluino. So the width is going to be, again, 1 over mass of the quark square, Now the Gluino couples as alpha S, as the strong coupling, whereas this guy is coupling as alpha electroweak, let's say electromagnetic. So we are going to have an alpha S square, sorry, an alpha S and an alpha electromagnetic. And we just have to match dimensions. This guy has to have mass dimension, so the phase space integration can only give the mass of the Gluino to the fifth. If that's because we are assuming that the Gluino is much heavier than the neutralino and the quarks. If the neutralino and the Gluino were similar in mass, that would be a completely different story. You could neglect the effect of the mass of the neutralino. So here I am neglecting two things. The dynamics of the quark, I'm just taking it over the mass, and also I'm neglecting the mass of the neutralino. So you can take this expression and massage it a little bit. So your gamma is going to go as the mass of mass of the Gluino over the mass of the quark to the fourth multiplied by the mass of the Gluino and some constants, alpha S and alpha electromagnetic. So what you can always do, so now I want to obtain numbers. What you will do is I take these guys and I say that's an order one dimensionless constant. This guy is a ratio, so that's dimensionless, that's nice. We keep it as it is. Sorry, to the fourth. But all the dimensions here are driven by the Gluino mass. So let's do the following. We are going to write mass of the Gluino over 100 GeVs. And then we are going to do 100 GeVs. And that, I've done nothing so far. I just put 100 GeVs on top and below. So this is a number, and I'm going to end up expressing this as a number times these ratios to the fourth in GeVs. And if I want to change from, instead of knowing the decay width, I want to know the lifetime or the decay length, I just use conversion factors from natural units. Would you be able to do that? Are you able to do this kind of thing? Should I do it? Okay. So now I have only one number, the ratio of the Gluino to the quark to the fourth. I already expressed the Gluino mass as in units of 100 GeVs, and then I'm multiplying by 100 GeVs. So you want length or you want time, the only thing you have to do is use a conversion factor. For example, h bar c is of order 200 MeVs per centimeter. Just think, what is the typical nuclear energy is per reaction? It's order hundreds of MeVs. Why, and what is the typical size of a nucleus is femtometer. So I couldn't go any other way. So you can always use this is equals one, so you can say that 200 10 to the minus 3 GeVs is equals 1 femtometer to the minus 1. So at the end of the day, your guy is going to look as some order 1, some ratio to the fourth. This is going to be order 1 as well, because we are assuming the Gluino is order 100 GeVs. And then we are just going to have something like, let's change also. We know 1 femtometer is 10 to the minus 15 meters. So this is going to be 10 to the 18 meters to the minus 1. Alright? So this ratio is very, very small, and it's to the fourth power. So if I want to know the decay length or estimate the decay length of the Gluino, I had to go as 1 over the gamma, and this is going to be 10 to the minus 18 meters over a very, very small ratio to the force. So easily, if there are some orders of magnitude between the gluino and the quark, we are going to obtain a very long decay length. So if you see, you have new physics with a particle with either very, very small couplings, or because of kinematics, like in this case, the gluino being much lighter than the quark, if by kinematics you had to produce a heavy particle of shell, immediately think about a long decay length. And this is interesting because if the particle is produced in a collider at the interaction point and it propagates and after a long time it decays back, then it produces a displaced vertex. So an interesting feature of having long lifetimes is the possibility of seeing a displaced vertex. The way you will see a displaced vertex is, okay, so this is my, of course, my collider, the beams are going like this. I produce a collision, and then I don't see anything, and then I see the decay products. So I wouldn't see anything if the intermediate particle, the lonely particle, is neutral. But if instead of a neutral particle I produce a gluino, the gluino is not neutral. It has some quantum numbers. What are they? It's a color particle, right? The gluino is the panel of the gluon, is a color particle. And the way the detectors work is to put a bunch of material in between the collision point and all the detection points. The idea is that the way they detect hadronic or electromagnetic radiation is precisely putting material, like obstacles, and then those obstacles will produce that the particle deposits some energy. But it can only deposit energy if this particle is charged. This gluino is charged, so it's going to deposit energy. So not only will we see a displaced vertex, we will also see some energy lost as a deposition inside the detector. Yes? Yes. Yeah, it doesn't have electric charge.
Yeah.
But it does.
We were talking about those debtors by getting energy, it's like electromagnetic.
Right? So, what are the detectors made of? In big lines. They are made of matter.
Yeah.
Okay. And what is matter made of? Yes. And so quarks have a strong coupling, experience strong interactions. So the gluon will interact with the quarks, the protons in the matter, and the neutrons of the matter.
So this gluon should hadronize, shouldn't it? So it'll actually be sort of big fat, heavy hadrons.
Yeah. There's an tricky thing about SPLIST2C that not only you produce this guy that stays there forever, but also because it's a color charge gluino, if the lifetime of the gluino is bigger or longer than the typical hadronization scale or lifetime time, then the gluino before decaying will be able to produce bound states, for example, of R hadrons. So it will be able to be, think of the gluino as a heavy object that is colored. So it means that when it's trying to move in a material that contains matter, then it's going to be dressed by all these quarks and gluons around. So the gluino, the simplest way of thinking about the R hadron is just a gluino that forms a bound state with a quark. So in SPLIST2C, the prediction is that this R hadron will be formed, and then after a very, very long time, the R hadron just decays because the gluino decays.
Are said that the displaced vertex is also a possible signature of extra dimensions.
Yes.
So you'd be able to tell the difference between this.
Oh, very good question. So we can have a displaced vertex of a particle that deposits energy, or we can also have a displaced vertex of a particle that is neutral. So it just propagates without feeling anything, and at some point, puff, decays into things that we can measure, like quarks or leptons. So that's a very good question. How do we distinguish different signatures for different models? The problem is that many models, many models, have the same signatures. So any signature that you see in supersymmetry, you can obtain in universal star dimensions, in Randall-Sundrum, in little Higgs. The signature, the way you will think that see that there is supersymmetry is because you will measure the spin of the particle. Because supersymmetry says, okay, so I have this guy, that is a gluino, but actually this gluino behaves exactly the same as a Kaluza-Klein gluon, which behaves exactly the same as any gluon of a, you know, extra SUN. Behaves exactly the same as any, for example, technicolor resonance that behaves as a gluon. The same, it has the same quantum number, so it's going to behave the same. What is different is the spin. In many of these other proposals, the spin of this gluon partner, so instead of a gluino, think of generically of a gluon partner. The gluon partner in SUSY is the gluino, the gluon partner in star dimensions is the Kaluza-Klein gluon. The gluon partner in Technicolor is the Techni gluon. But the signature of supersymmetry is that the gluon partner is going to be a spin 1/2 fermion, whereas the other guys are spin 1 bosons. So you need to measure spin, and this is a delicate question. How to measure spin is difficult in a very nasty machine as the LHC. So let's say, that's why you often hear from people like me saying, okay, the LHC is going to be discovered supersymmetry, no matter what is the real physics. They discover supersymmetry, and then when we try to characterize supersymmetry, we may find out that it's not this, but some other weird stuff. And that's a very good question. So many models share the same signatures, and even using all the capabilities of the LHC in the next 10 years, we may not be able to distinguish between models. And that they call that degeneracy among models. Yes?
So to measure the spin of a particle in an accelerator, do you need to look at what it decays to or selection?
Yes, exactly. So you need to look, for example, let's say that this guy decays into E plus E minus or something like this. Then you need to look at the angle between these two and work out what would be your prediction for a spin 1 particle or a spin 1 half particle. Yes?
So if it decays in a particle that you can't see,
it's good. Yes, good. Yes, indeed.
You don't know the spin of that particle.
Indeed. So that's a problem of models that have these parities. I try to explain dark matter. As I told you, they also produce missing energy signatures because the dark matter candidate must be neutral. So you have a stable particle, it will be the end of anything you do, the end of the cascade of whatever you are doing, and this is seen as missing energy. In principle, you can, if you are very, very lucky, you could reconstruct missing energy.
But there might be a missing spin. If this particle has spin, depending on what it is.
So there is one caveat. Like, if there was one single missing energy particle, or a neutral particle in your event, you would be able to reconstruct some of the momentum of this particle just by conservation of momentum in transverse space. The problem is that in supersymmetry, you usually assume a parity, and the parity tells you that you should pair-produce supersymmetric particles. So in supersymmetry, you always have two sources of missing energy, at least. And then you are screwed. Yes, that's a very good point. Okay?
Yes, exactly. And then she said, well, what if I didn't know that, or what if I lost this information? And so you can still try and find correlations.
Yeah. It's important to think on theoretical ways of this, of determining the spin, but it's even more important to account for the capabilities of the detector. What you think is a perfect experiment is not a perfect perfect experiment. So we need to simulate this. All right. Yes.
In the states that you were talking about from the
the Calusa climbing.
Yeah, what would these states be for the other planets?
So in large star dimensions or ADS, in any of those proposals that try to solve the hierarchy problem, the picture is very similar at low energies. At low energies, you expect your standard model of particles, the top, for example, and above that, you would expect some either the Higgs or no Higgs if you are doing Higgsless, and then you should expect things that look like a W prime or a Z prime, for sure. Because if you want to solve the electroweak symmetry breaking problem, you need to talk to the W's and Z's. So those guys for sure will have K Kaluza Klein resonances. So those are WKK, ZKK. So one generic signature of large star dimensions or random sundum is that the tower in large star dimensions and random sundum is slightly different, because in random sundum, you obtain the mass of the Kaluza Klein as the zeros of a Bessel function, J1, J0, whatever. Whereas the tower in large star dimensions, this is RS, large star dimension, this is just the zeros of a cosinus or a sinus.
What about for the particles which are not the W and the Z?
That depends on your setup. Like, if whatever thing you put in the bulk, if you localize in the IR, doesn't matter where you localize it, you will have a Kaluza Klein tower starting more or less at the same time as this.
Okay.
And
so it's the same energy as the
higher level. Excellent. So both in LED and random sundum, you get the same mass. It's just because in this case, instead of being 1/1, the mass, instead of being the very large M Planck curvature, happens to be worked down to the TED scale. So the fundamental theory in ADS has very large scales, but the way you feel it from the point of view of electroweak symmetry breaking is worked down. Whereas in the other guy, it's already 1/r or ordered M Planck, which is TED for large star dimensions. But so you see that you have two completely different theories, similar predictions. Because to be able to distinguish LED from RS, we need to see the first guy and the second guy, and then compare. But the second guy, the prediction is that this guy is as broad as your mom. So you produce a resonance, but it's very, very broad. So experimentally, this is difficult. It's not even clear that you will be able to say this is RS or large star dimension. And from these classes we just had a few days ago, you see that you can call this the Kaluza Klein resonances, you can also call them the raw technicolor and the A1 technicolor, resonances of technicolor. And there is no way of distinguishing that. So if we find some new resonances at the LHC, we will call them gluon partner, quark partner, W partner, and it will take some time until we distinguish them from being supersymmetric partners or any other type. And even when we say, okay, so it's a spin one resonance, it's really a W prime or a Z prime, we won't know if it's a W prime Z prime from some extra SUN or a technicolor scenario or a Caruso-Klein scenario. The only smoking gun of extra dimensions, as real extra dimensions, not as a tool, is that we form black holes. And that's going to be very hard also. Not to, what is hard is to produce them. If they decay, don't worry, we'll find them. That's not a problem.
How do you make the lighter particles have their zero load much lighter than non-zero?
Yes. The only place I can answer clearly is in Ares. In Ares, I will say, okay, so in Ares, I know that here is where I'm producing electroweak symmetry breaking. So this is the scale of electroweak symmetry breaking. So I can choose to localize my zero mode over here, or over here, or in the center, or whatever I want. So by choosing this, you remember, the way we were tuning this is by changing the mass in the bulk of the fermion, for example, over here. So by choosing different order one masses, you end up with completely different profiles. So when you look at the mass, the effective mass that this guy gets in the bulk is actually, for example, for this, is exponentially suppressed. For this, is an order one. For this, is volume suppressed. So the way you keep your zero mode light is by choosing this guy, order of this guy, and localizing it near the ultraviolet. So and remember, this was the cute thing about Ares, is that you can generate hierarchies. This guy is much, much less massive than this guy, but there is no symmetry. Nothing is protecting this guy from being so light. It's just a dynamical effect in the bulk of the star dimensions. More questions over there? So you want to come out and explain lattice a little bit? Yes, come. I got some questions about, I'm always saying, oh, non-perturbative, use the dual. But there is an alternative, and it's to try to do a brute force computation in the lattice. So you probably want this. And Max works in lattice theory, so can explain to you better.
So, for anybody who hasn't met me, my name is Mark Wirtz, and I did lattice gauge theories for my master's at University of Saskatchewan. And I'm at York University right now, and I'm doing more lattice work, doing a lot of work with scalars, working with Randy Lewis and Veronica as well. And I guess, like I know in this program, they haven't really talked about lattice at all. And it's this big thing that lots of people do, and it gives important results, but you guys haven't really taken anything on it. And so I guess if I was to say in simplest words, what is the lattice, is simply doing quantum field theory with numbers. Like usually when you think, what is a field, you think, oh, a field is an operator that acts on an abstract state, and it's all kind of very abstract, the whole description. But in lattice gauge theories, and anything lattice, basically the fields are just numbers. And kind of the way that things get started is with the path integral formulation. So that's where things kind of differ quite a bit from what you've done before. Like canonical stuff, you use operators all the time. And for the path integral, you get something that looks like this. And automatically, like, that looks mysterious. And basically what it is we're summing over all possible values of the field at every single point in space-time. So another way to write it out is that we're integrating over, like, when I think of the path integral, I think that fields are actually numbers, not operators. Like phi can equal 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, something like that. And I think of it as this is an infinite number of integrations. And for every single point in space-time, we integrate over the action, over all possible values of the field, with this phase weighting here given by the action. Now, numerically, it's impossible to do an infinite number of integrations over an infinite number of space-time points. So one of the first things that the lattice does, and I'm not sure how much detail to go into here, but I figure I'd just like describe the bare-bone basics, and hopefully that is what you guys want to hear. Like when we do physics, we always have a space-time continuum where there's an infinite number of points along here. But basically what the lattice is it says we just discretize space and time into a finite number of points. So the important point here is that this is not a fundamental statement of space-time. There are some physical theories that say, oh, space-time is fundamentally discrete at the Planck scale. We're not saying that. We're just saying that we're doing an approximation. And so there's going to be some error associated with this approximation of having only a finite number of points with some finite space between each point. So like between each point, there's going to be a distance in which the field won't change. And the space between each one of those points is called the lattice spacing. And the way the lattice gets its name is just because all the points in space just look like a lattice. And so when you think of a field as a function of space and time, basically, the field phi is given a value at each one of these points, but not in between.
So then which symmetry this is breaking? So that this is saying.
Yeah. So if you try to rotate the coordinates into each other, it wouldn't quite work because they're not, you would get something like that. And so, yeah, it's not really invariant under space-time rotations and Lorentz invariants. But that's one of the prices you have to pay for, like, to do the computations.
It's so, you can't regularize. There's no sense in which you have using the limit to make it more. You don't have to turn to infinite before.
Yeah. So since the field is like on these values, you can imagine phi could be like a wave and could have different wavelengths. And so there's a minimum wavelength because we can't have a field that oscillates at a high frequency like that because the field has no values in between these two points. So there's a maximum energy or maximum momentum that the field can have. And that's basically given by the lattice spacing. So typically what people say is that the cutoff for our energy cutoff is 1 over the lattice spacing. And as we go to the continuum limit, then the cutoff gets bigger and bigger. And I guess you have to be a little bit careful about does your theory like become trivial or something like that. I know in lambda phi the four theories, you have to worry about that. So I'm not really sure what to say about all of that, but I think the most important thing would be to stick to the basics. And
all you seem to say is that the way lattice is working is attacking the problem directly. These guys are really computing the action and minimizing it. they are doing it in a finite space-time, in a lattice space-time, but they do it. Whereas the way we do it usually is to assume some small coupling and perturb over this small coupling. So the lattice is able to attack problems as strong coupling because there is no assumption about the strength of the coupling.
Mm-hmm.
So it, all the limitation of the lattice is how well we can take this limit of the A going to zero. Because the physics we want is this one. But there is no limitation, so in principle that these computations are sensitive to non-perturbative effects. That's why it's a very nice alternative to, for example, the dynamic radio equation. Well, alternative is precisely what we are using to compute the electricity that is fixed.
Do you mean Kelsey space, or do you actually, because computationally I would have thought that'd be horrible.
Yeah, what you actually do is, like this is Minkowski space, and you do a Wick rotation to Euclidean space-time. So now basically we're just using imaginary time. And what that does is the action picks up a factor of I, and then this e to the is becomes e to the minus s. So now the path integral, this part is totally real, and it basically resembles a Boltzmann distribution. And when people say, I want to completely calculate this path integral, there's still too many integrations, and numerically it would still be impossible because all these different phis are coupled to each other, and it would be a nested integral with a large number of loops that you would have to do on the computer, and it would just take an infinite number of time to actually do it. So what people say is we'll use statistical methods instead. Basically what we'll do to calculate this path integral is we'll select the most important configurations of the field. So this e to the minus s basically says that if the action is very large, a certain field configuration that produces a large action will create a very small contribution. But ones that minimize action, like those closest to the classical limit, will produce the biggest contribution. So what we can do is just treat this as a distribution and generate fields, a finite number of field configurations, and basically average over them. So let's say I generate generate 100 field configurations. I can estimate quantities from the path integral using just those 100 field configurations that were selected, like basically by an important sampling algorithm. Say which ones will statistically contribute the most. And so you can actually get away with using a very small number of field configurations. And what's a field configuration? It basically says at each point here, the field has a number. And so we'll generate a value of the field at every point, and that'll be one field configuration.
I guess I should also say that because the formalism is limited to the Euclidean, then there's no way of doing or defining asymptotic states in the physical sense of a scattering. So there is no way of doing a scattering in that. So the thing they can do is to find time, and it's already something bound states, for example, of the strong copy, but B mesons and things like this. But they cannot describe a scattering where strong interactions are involved. Because the scattering means that you have a well defined in and out state, and you don't have that in the equilibrium. You have questions?
Yep.
So this is your method for finding this. It's not Monte Carlo methods.
It's definitely Monte Carlo methods.
But you say you select the field that contribute the most. You don't like select them randomly, or do you?
Yeah, we do select them randomly. So it's important sampling, but it's all the field configurations are supposed to be random and completely unrelated to each other. The way we actually do this is we'll start off with an initial field configuration called phi zero, so it's just a number at every single point in space and time. And then we'll apply some algorithm, and it'll take the previous one and give us a new one. And so, theoretically, these two should not be related to each other. If they are, then it'll give us a biased result. But if we do enough of these, then eventually it should be, you should come up with a field configuration that is statistically independent. And then that's good. So we have two field configurations that kind of represent this distribution of the action. And so it's like all the dynamics in the action, the coupling, the strong coupling, all the different particle interactions are basically represented by the statistical distribution of the fields in this Monte Carlo chain.
So your steps follow some statistical distribution?
Yeah.
Using Boltzmann.
Yeah, it starts off with the Boltzmann distribution, and we apply some algorithm, and it gives us kind of a chain of configurations that follow this distribution. And they will be related to each other by our algorithm, because we can't generate the whole field configuration by itself. We have to visit each point individually, because to do all the points at once would be way too complicated. There's no algorithm that would do that for you, no algorithm that would give you the whole thing all at once. So we visit each one individually, and each point talks to its neighbors. And so each point will kind of remember its previous history through its interaction with its neighbors. So that's why we have to do several steps. We have to apply the algorithm a bunch of times, and then we get a point that eventually doesn't remember its long past anymore. It's just like with humans, you don't remember your great-great-great-great ancestors. You don't know exactly where they came from unless you kept very rigorous documents. So it's the same type of thing here. Eventually the fields will forget their ancestors, and when they do that, then they're totally unbiased from the previous configurations. And the reason that's important is because you want to generate a statistical distribution where each point is independent of all the other ones. And so I guess one of the really funny things is that you can do quantum field theory, you can do it with numbers, and you can use a completely different method. You use statistical mechanics instead. And a lot of interesting things happen, because basically the way the fields evolve in this chain resembles a statistical system. So it's basically thermodynamics. So quantum field theory, when you apply this method, reduces to a thermodynamical system. And just as a quick example, if I had like the vacuum expectation value of a field, and then here was the number of Monte Carlo iterations, if I started with some initial field up here, and let's say the equilibrium value was right here, as I apply this algorithm, so I'm starting with phi 0, then phi 1, and phi 2, they will approach equilibrium. And so the algorithm itself drives them towards the equilibrium. But then they don't just stay at equilibrium. They kind of fluctuate around a little bit. And so it's basically like a, this can be sometimes you can think of it as a converge to a certain temperature, but they still fluctuate around that temperature a little bit. And it's these fluctuations that actually hold all the dynamics from the original action. So I guess that's kind of some of the little things on how the lattice works, how it's really neat, because if you do it, you get a totally different perspective on how quantum field theory works. And you can think of it from a thermodynamical point of view. Yeah.
It varies. How do you talk about spin one, spin half? I mean, what's the difference between all these different kinds of bosonic fermionic fields?
I'm not too sure how to answer that. Like,
you say you do gauge theory, so what do you mean by gauge theory on a lattice?
Oh.
What I did before was...
the XY model, right?
John, <it's funny.
laughs> I did SU2 gauge theory with interacting with the SU2 Higgs particle. And so, for that, I don't know, we didn't really calculate the spin of the gauge bosons at all. We didn't.
You lattice the action, assuming already a spin. You
yeah.
Have a different action for spin one.
Yeah, and I know that fermions are very difficult to simulate on the lattice. And scalars are much simpler. That's what we're doing right now. So you have to be very skilled to do fermions on the lattice. And I admire people who do.
So when you say simulate, do you mean like quantum Monte Carlo calculations?
Yeah.
So that's where you get this sine problem, which is why the fermions are so impossible, right?
Yeah, I've never attempted it, so I can't say exactly what the problem is. One problem, like, it's weird, it's called fermion doubling, where for each dimension you have, the number of fermions effectively doubles when you put them on the lattice. And that might be related to the sine problem. I'm not sure.
Yeah. I mean, the sine problem has to do with the fact that the propagator, you know, it's complex. It's not positive. The amplitude for the transition from one state to the next is not necessarily a positive number. That makes the averaging very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, trying to put fermions on the lattice was one of the starting points of external measures. So, Kaplan et al. Tried to do that using thinking of fermions in five dimensions where there is a domain wall. And that seemed to help on the lattice simulation, but this was really what you ended up doing in large dimensions or other studios. So, the part of the inspiration came from that, it's not from the deep brains.
Okay.
I do find solutions with new ideas.
You say you can simulate scattering process. Why don't you try to do some kind of diffusion thing?
So you can compute endpoint correlators in the Brillouin space. But what you cannot compute is a real scattering. But that doesn't mean you cannot compute couplings or masses. You can compute those from the correlators. That's, for example, an exponential decay because there is a mass. Yeah. But yeah, I don't think there is any advancement in the scattering of the lattice.
Yeah, I think it's mostly just for calculating bound states of particles, which is why it's so useful for QCD, because you can, calculate the mass ratios of bound states. And those masses are basically just given by the strong dynamics of the SU3 gauge fields.
For example, when we want to simulate the hadronization in a collision, we don't use lattice. What we do is to use a model, a very simple model of a string. So really, this is one of the fancy points in the Monte Carlo modeling for collider phenomenology, that we don't know how hadronization happens. And that this is not going to be able to tell us in the engineering system. Okay.
Are you finished or are you going
by? Some people have some questions.
are those people certified? You can come to me at VTR this afternoon. Whoever. I guess if you have questions about the homework, you can ask me or come.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, thanks, Veronica, for coming. It's great having you here. And
they are great.
Yeah, oh yeah, that too. And so here is a memento of your visit. Actually, it's part of a collection which you can acquire over the years.
I remember.
Okay, so
thank you. Thank you very much. It was great. Well,